Well, when was the last time you bought a car battery? Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. I was thinking back trying to count up the number of batteries, car batteries I've bought in my lifetime, and there's a pretty good pile there. And there's a guy that's probably dealt, I know, has dealt with many, many more car batteries than I have, Jim Ward. In the studio with me today, Service Director at Smart Motors. Over 10 years of master certification with Smart Motors of Madison, and always fun to have him come by. Today we'll be talking with him about what you should know about your battery. He will also take your other vehicle questions as well, of course, he always does. And if you have questions maybe about jump-starting your car, your batteries, what problems do you have with your car? Give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Jim Ward, good to see you again. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks, Larry. It's good to be here. My battery did its job, so I got here no fuss today.
That's good. Well, that's... these days we have electric cars, we got hybrid vehicles, we get gas powered. When it comes to batteries, what do we need to know about the differences?
Well, there's really greater differences in batteries that you might find in a vehicle than there ever has been. Of course, with hybrids, you've got two completely different kinds of battery. You've got a large, used to be nickel hydride, now lithium ion type batteries that are not a battery you maintain yourself or do anything with. That strictly take it into a qualified technician. Those vehicles typically also have a conventional 12-volt battery, and those hybrid 12-volt batteries usually are very small. They're not asked really to start the car. They run the computers and the electrical system. They're often not a good candidate for jump-starting other cars. They can do it, but if the other car's battery is really, really discharged, and it's a real challenge, the small hybrid 12-volt battery may not even be able to do that. And, of course, in other applications beyond vehicles, there's deep-cycle batteries, marine-type batteries that are used in RVs and boats and everything. But for automotive, the battery... batteries are primarily no maintenance anymore. A battery service... used to mean that you would take the caps off and you would check the fluid in the cell and use a hydrometer to make sure that was one type of test, to test that fluid and keep it up. And they would use them because charging systems used to be less sophisticated. It wouldn't be uncommon for a car's charging system to maybe overcharge the battery a little bit and that fluid would go down. And so a battery service involved a whole set of processes that we just rarely ever even see anymore. They're maintenance-free. So now it comes to the surface and the terminals of the battery. You've got two different kinds of metal that tends to be an environment that corrosion will build up in, and that's always been true. It was true before. It's true on new maintenance-free batteries as well. Add to that living in Wisconsin where you got some salt on the road, and it just exasperates that problem. And so that part's still really not different. And that's probably one of the biggest things to do to maintain your battery besides driving the car regularly and not leaving it set, not leaving things on is to keep those terminals clean so that you've got a good connection so that it's getting the charge. And we see battery technologies come a long way. Even the conventional 12-volt batteries last longer than they ever have.
I haven't had a lot of problems in recent years. Todd in Delavan emailed to ask, he thinks the newer batteries in newer vehicles die with no warning. And he remembers the old days, as he says in quotes, when lights would start dimming and you'd kind of knew things were coming to an end.
Sure. And there's some truth to that we do see bad cells go in a battery and more of a sudden. That's not to say that you won't still have the slow cranking and the lights. That does happen. And I'd say that probably happens the majority of time. But we do see a bit of an uptick in batteries that just... they seem fine yesterday and they fall on their face very suddenly. That being said, battery testing technologies come a long way too, and the testers are not so much just the static test of what the battery is like right now, but they're able to do some predictive analysis to tell what the health of the battery is and what its long-term chances of lasting 3 to 6 months are. You may very well have a sudden surprise, and that's one of the reasons a good thing to have is one of those little charge packs. You could have jumper cables, which will work, and as long as you've got somebody else to help you. They make jump packs that a handful of years ago were about the size of a breadbasket, I guess I'll say, fairly heavy, and now with the lithium ion, they're not much larger. They're maybe twice the size and a little heavier than a cell phone. And you can use those. They got USB. You can put little jacks on them to jumpstart a battery. You can charge your phone. You can charge all kinds of devices. So handy things to have.
Yeah, absolutely. Keep yourself out of trouble. When you're using the jumper cables, you got to be careful how you use them. And I think maybe a year or two ago, we talked about this once on the show, but it always bears repeating.
Yep. It's a simple enough process, but there's a lot that can go wrong. And when things go wrong, often people get lucky and not much damage is done, but a lot of damage can be done to the point of even injury because of what can happen. And so that's why the process is really important. If you're going to jumpstart a vehicle, you want to have the vehicles close but never touching. You're always going to take the red battery clamp from the jumper cables and put that red on the positive of the dead battery first, and then you're going to put the other red one on the good battery. And then the next, you're going to take the black negative, and you're going to put that on the good battery. And then lastly, and it would seem intuitive to think you're going to put the other black negative one on the dead battery, but you're not. You want to put that somewhere on a heavy engine part, some unpainted metal surface. It could be down by the frame, but usually near the top of the engine. A lot of engines have a little hook that is intended to be used if the engine's pulled out. Not all engines have that, but you want to find a metal surface away from the battery. Batteries that are discharged often through the discharge process have had gases that have been outgassing from it, and they'll be over that battery. So putting that last clamp on there will often create a spark. It's probably going to create a spark wherever you do put it, but you don't want that to be right over the battery. You don't want to have that ignition source. People will probably say, oh, I've done that lots of times. I've seen those sparks and nothing happened. And that's true. I would say, probably 99.9% of the time, nothing happens. You don't want to be that
1%
of the time, because that's a horrible explosion. There's a fire danger there. But once you have the cables properly connected, you'll hear varying versions of what to do next. Some people will tell you to have the vehicle that is the good battery running. It that does provide a little bit more voltage. Some people say to have it running and rev it up. Preferably, you'd just be able to do this battery to battery without the vehicle running. But you do want to leave it connected a few minutes, because it's the dead battery is absorbing some charge. It's not. Yep. It you don't want to be an instantaneous thing and draw everything right off of the donor battery right off the bat. But after waiting a few minutes, you should be able to get in. If it was a battery problem, start the vehicle that had the discharge battery, and then you want to go out and disconnect those cables in the reverse order that you connected them. And ultimately, then that vehicle that you just jump started really should be driven. Probably a half hour, really, 20 minutes to a half hour at highway speed to charge that battery back up, because you don't want to drive 10 minutes, shut it off, and when you come back to it, you're going to have to go through this again.
Yeah, don't want to do that again. Jim Ward, our guest service director at Smart Motors of Madison, and we're ready to take your questions or comments. You can join in. We'll get you on pretty quickly here at 1-800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Brad in Minnesota emailed that he has a question about automatic transmission fluid change on his 2000 GMC Sierra rear wheel drive. It's got 150,000 miles on it. His brother-in-law is an ASE certified mechanic at Chevrolet dealership, and he told Brad to have the fluid changed, but not to have the transmission flushed due to the age of the transmission. Does this sound right, or should he even worry at all? Last time it was done was 2010.
Well, the fluid, it should be changed at manufacturer intervals, and most manufacturers don't necessarily recommend a flush. But an automatic transmission's got a device inside called a torque converter. It's what takes the place of the clutch you'd operate in a manual transmission. That torque converter is a big device that holds a lot of fluid. And when you simply take the drain plug out and drain the fluid like you would with engine oil, you don't get all the fluid. Most of it stays in that torque converter. And so that method is going to get some of the fluid out. It's not going to get all of it out, and that's why flushing machines are typically used to flush the whole thing out. And the concern is that on older vehicles, the older it gets, that you might have varnish built up somewhere in the transmission, or you may have some bit of gasket or forming place gasket that got a little bit loose, and that by flushing it, you're going to create pressures that are going to cause that to dislodge and plug something up somewhere. And, well, I wouldn't say that that's impossible. it's not an issue I really see happen. The transmission produces pretty good pressures when it's operating, when you're driving it anyway. So what I typically recommend and what we do is a transmission flush at the interval that the manufacturer recommends servicing that transmission fluid.
That makes good sense. Well, we have some callers online. Again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Glenn in Appleton has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Glenn.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just heard you talk about jump-starting a vehicle, but I was wondering about, you know, I've got a battery charger, and how that might be, well, if you want to charge a battery in a car, or maybe it's your lawnmower, how that might, you know, what your do's and don'ts or suggestions on having a charger and connecting that, or...
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, similarly, you want to connect, you know, well, first of all, you want to look at what the settings on the charger are. There are all variety of types of chargers and quality of chargers. There are chargers that will do both 6-volt and 12-volt, and you want to make sure that you know what you've got. You know, when you look at your lawnmower battery, it's about a third, sometimes a quarter of the size of a car or a truck battery. You might presume that must be a 6-volt battery. In most cases, it's not. It's a 12-volt battery as well. And most chargers will have at least a couple of settings. You know, most chargers somebody's going to have in their garage is probably going to have a 2-amp and a 6-amp charge settings. If it's a small battery like the lawnmower, you want to use that lower rating. If it's a frozen battery or a very, very discharged battery that you think might be partially frozen in the winter, you don't want to suddenly put a high rate of charge in there. You'd use that lower rate. Charging at a lower rate for a longer period of time generally is healthier for the battery, so that would be your goal. But you don't want to, for example, if you're storing a car, you're not going to take a battery charger and connect it to it at the beginning of the storage season and leave it on there. It's going to burn all of the fluid out of that battery and create a mess and possibly a fire hazard. In those situations, they have smart chargers, or typically a brand name's battery tender, that will sense the state of charge. It'll turn on and charge it when it should, shut off when it shouldn't. So in that application, that's what you'd use for it. If you have a vehicle that doesn't start, that you want to you know, some more expensive batteries, and what shops typically have will have a jump starting rate that's a, you know, more than a charge rate that might start a car immediately. But if you are otherwise just using a regular home, like most people would have in their garage battery charger, you're not really going to jump start the car. You're going to have to leave that on there for a few hours. But typically, if you're not driving a car, the battery should be charged about every 6 weeks. So you don't have, if you have access to the car and it's not in storage where you can't get to it, you could just take a conventional battery charger and go charge that battery for, you know, 6 to 8 hours every 6 weeks and mm-hmm. should maintain it.
All right. Thanks, Glenn, for calling. Ed in West Allis, your turn. Hi, Ed.
Good morning.
What's on your mind?
I'd like to know the function of the timing belt in the engine, and then I want to know why it costs like about $5,000 to repair it.
Timing belt. What's the function of a timing belt?
Well, the timing belt and the name belt is a bit of a misnomer. More and more engines have timing chains. If you imagine a bicycle with the front sprocket and the rear sprocket, and the chain is in those gears of the sprocket, and it keeps it synchronized. Now, if that chain jumps on a bicycle, it's probably no big deal. You probably are going to have your leg jump ahead a little bit. I remember as a kid just learning to ride a bike on an old worn-out bike. You know, you might, that chain jumping might make you scrape your foot on the ground if you're in the wrong position. It was coming around. But in an engine of a car, that timing belt has gear cog teeth on it. So like the bicycle chain, it isn't just a belt like, you know, one that's on the outside of the motor that drives your alternator or your air conditioner and is just a friction fit. It's a belt that you should think of more like a chain, and it has to keep things perfectly synchronized. On most engines, if that belt jumps one tooth, it probably won't run. And it may do severe engine damage. Basically, the valves, the intake and exhaust valves that bring in the fuel and let the exhaust out, are timed with the lower part of the engine, the crankshaft that runs the piston up and down, that's got to be in just the right position. Those things, if they're allowed to freewheel, don't have clearance. On what's called an interference engine, they can hit. And on some types of engine, even the valves can hit each other, which can do catastrophic engine damage. So replacing a timing belt as maintenance usually doesn't cost the $5,000. Not replacing it, having it jump and damage the engine, is where the $5,000 comes in. But it's inside the motor. It's not simply on the outside and a simple belt to replace. So it's several hundred dollars on most vehicles to replace a timing belt at its interval, and it certainly should be replaced at its interval to prevent that. But it is basically the thing that keeps the heart and lungs of the engine in time together and synchronized so that it runs properly, and more importantly, it doesn't do catastrophic damage by parts touching each other that aren't meant to touch each other.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. And again, it's not $5,000 for that.
No. Timing belt replacement typically isn't. A timing belt failure can result in that or greater expense.
All right. There we go. Thanks, Ed. Appreciate the call. And Paul in Madison, will go to you. Hi, Paul.
I was charging my car over a period of time, and I went outside and noticed there was a celery smell in the air. Was I charging it too long? Was the battery charger mucked up?
It likely was either too high a rate of charge or charging too long. I mean, you know, we've had that experience. It doesn't happen often, but I had a tech forget, leave a battery charger on a battery overnight, come back the next morning, the whole shop just reeked of sulfur. Typically it's one of those two things, either too high a rate of charge for that battery or on there too long.
Well, there we go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And in that kind of a situation, when you've got that, is that a situation where you got to replace the battery?
It was an instance that I was referring to. It may not always be, you know, if you just noticed a light odor, I mean, you are exciting the battery. It is going to create some of that gas. So a light odor of that doesn't necessarily mean anything went wrong, but if it's a strong odor, it means one of those things went, and it can have a detrimental effect on the life of the battery, even if it doesn't, ruin it right then.
Larry in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Larry.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a comment, first of all. We retired to Arizona several years ago, and going from Wisconsin to Arizona, we expected our car battery to last a while.
Uh-huh.
But when we got out there, we discovered that car batteries last only 18 to 24 months. And I'm wondering, what is the difference between the colder weather, what influence it has on the battery, and the hotter weather?
Yeah.
Well, the hot weather is definitely more detrimental. If you took the country and split it into forests, that bottom tier that's got the Florida Panhandle and most of Texas and all of that high climate, they typically have the shortest battery life, 2 to 3 years. Heat is much harder on batteries than cold. That being said, the reason we think of cold and the cold being detrimental for batteries is that if your battery discharges in a cold climate when it's freezing out, the lack of charge in it will allow it to freeze. And once the battery freezes, that's probably going to ruin it. Whereas in a warmer climate, if you forget and leave something on and the battery discharges, you can usually just simply charge that battery back up. But it's very true that bottom tier of the country, 2 to 3 years is kind of max battery life. You get up about the next 200 to 300, 400 or 500 miles of the country, and you get 3 to 4 years. And actually, we get the longest life out of batteries up here in the northern tier, across Michigan and Wisconsin and on to the west at that latitude. We typically will get 4 to 6 years out of it. But the heat is a much greater enemy of batteries than the cold. That's true.
So I'm going to tell your neighbors who live in or your friends who live in the South, well, yeah, you may have warm weather, but our batteries are going to last longer. There you go, Larry. Thanks for calling. Jim Ward, Service Director at Smart Motors. Our guest today, I'm Larry Mueller, Jill Nadeau, our producer, Dave Potratz, our engineer on the Ideas Network. Talking vehicle maintenance today with Jim Ward, Service Director at Smart Motors of Madison. Always great to have Jim come by. He knows so much, and he's certainly ready to answer your questions. The lines are filled right now. The number is 800-642-1234. You could email us at ideas@wpr.org. And let's see if we can empty a line here. Bob in Madison, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Hi, Larry. Yeah, I have a question about transmission fluid. I have a Toyota RAV4, and I had my transmission fluid changed. And they asked me if I wanted Toyota brand transmission fluid or another kind of transmission fluid, another brand that was up to the same specs. So I took the other kind of fluid. It was a little cheaper. So they changed it, and then on my invoice, it said, printed out, that basically that I should have used Toyota genuine transmission fluid because it may cause deterioration in shift quality, locking up of the transmission accompanied by vibration, and ultimately damage the transaxle of the vehicle. So then I had the Toyota fluid put in, and I'm wondering if that was needed or...
Okay.
If it's the right type of fluid, the brand doesn't really matter. I mean, as you can probably imagine, Toyota doesn't make transmission fluid. They buy it from, you know, from oil distilleries, just like you know, anything else. So I mean, it gets a manufacturer may have oil distillery make a fluid to a certain spec that might be slightly different than generic, but really, if it's the right type of fluid, that doesn't matter. At one point, most fluids were Dextron based, and as a Dextron 2, as you'd get different evolutions and generations of the fluid, each one would cover all the specs of all the earlier ones. So if you got a later car, you could use that latest fluid. If you had an older car, you could use the latest fluid in it. Now with synthetic transmission fluids, they're not so compatible with each other, and that's one of the reasons a lot of new cars don't even have a transmission dipstick, because they don't want to take the chance that someone's going to put a funnel on there and put the wrong kind of fluid in, cross-contaminate and ruin it. But if they were using the right type of fluid, then that really shouldn't have mattered. I think the disclaimer they put on there is, and it seems incongruent that a shop would recommend that fluid and then put a disclaimer on saying that you shouldn't have used this fluid. But, you know, it's certainly true the wrong kind of fluid can do damage and not properly lubricate the transmission. But if it's the right kind of fluid, the brand really is secondary.
There you go. Thank you, Bob, for calling. And Mike in Menominee Falls, your turn.
Hi. I have a 1998 Subaru Forester, and the guy I bought from thought it had all-wheel drive, and I found out when it snowed that it didn't. And he had told me that there's a high-voltage fuse under the hood for that, and when I pull that out, there's no clicks, there's no noise, everything's the same, except I get a light on in the dash indicating it's only in two-wheel drive. I was wondering if that's just an electrical unit on the transmission that needs to be changed.
Hmm. Well, it could be. I mean, ultimately, the vehicle is primarily front-wheel drive, and the way it's designed is the way it's supposed to work is that when it senses rear-wheel slip, then the rear drive would engage as well. And there are several components that may not be working right that's not going to tell it that. If it's not getting the signal that there's a rear slip, it's not going to engage those. Basically, there's some basic circuit testing that needs to be done to find out. You know, you could have a mechanical problem with a viscous cuff or something that's supposed to engage that, but, you know, it's certainly something that can be diagnosed. They need to find out if they have the right signals in the right places to tell it that to engage in four-wheel drive, and then the right signal's coming back to actually do that. And if that all tests all right, then they've got to start looking for mechanical problems with that rear differential and coupler.
All right, but that's pretty straightforward. The testing?
It's probably not something that's a do-it-yourself kind of thing,
yeah,
but it is.
Take it
to a shop, and they'll be able to figure it out.
All right, yep. There we go. Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it. On to Gary in Appleton. Hi, Gary.
Hi. I have a question. I saw there was an advertisement. Apparently, a company in Australia makes a capacitor battery jumper instead of a lithium-ion battery or some other battery system. What it does, you put it on the battery, you wait a while for the capacitors to charge up, and then you start the car, and this lower voltage or lower power, some power transfers the capacitor start and then jump starts the car. Do you know anything about that? And is it effective?
I'm not familiar with that, but if I understood right, this is a device that you're putting on the discharged battery that is somehow going to slowly over time absorb enough power from that battery to create a capacitive sudden discharge. And I guess what capacitors do is you get a capacitor charge and then it can release a much greater power rate than what it was charged at very briefly and very suddenly.
Is that what you were talking about?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yep. So, I don't know that I would say that wouldn't work, but if you have, You know, I think of the scenario of in the spring when I go to start my lawnmower and I crank it and wonder, like we all do.
Yeah.
You know, I might be able to, it might start, I might have to get the charger out. If a battery is near discharge enough that it's not likely to start the car, taking that last bit of power out to try to, it seems like a less desirable way to do it, to my thinking. I'm not familiar with the device, and that's one of the things I love about this show is I get to write a couple things down, do some research, and see if I learn something new. But you know, if a battery's not too discharged, I mean, I can't say that this wouldn't work, but man, the convenience and ease of these lithium deals that you can charge your cell phone or some other little device as well as jumpstart your car are hard to beat. So, but I'm gonna have to research that one. That again, you know, technologically speaking, it could work, but I just don't see how it would be more desirable.
Yeah, there we go, Gary. Thank you for calling. Maybe you can give us a report next time around, Jim.
Yeah.
We'll look at it. We'll look into it. So stay listening. You're back February 21st, so we'll do it again. Anne in Lac des Flambeaux, your turn. Hi, Anne.
Hi, I think it's Pam.
Oh, Pam, sorry.
That's okay. My question is, I have a car that is now out of warranty, but has over 60,000 miles, so I need to do the checkup. And I'm wondering about the difference of going to the car dealer versus an auto repair shop that says they can do the 60,000-mile checkup, because the price is significantly different.
Well, the one question is, if the price is different, are we talking apples and apples? You should have a maintenance book with the car that tells you what the maintenance intervals are. Often it's right with the owner's manual. Sometimes it's a separate book about the same size but not as thick as the owner's manual. So it'll tell you for a given car at 60,000 miles, there's a list and these are the things that you do. It's not uncommon for both dealerships and independent shops to recommend additional things. You know, they may feel that it is in this climate that you also need to consider doing this, and that isn't really uncommon. And in some makes of cars, some models, you know, there are things that the manufacturer didn't include that may be a good idea in certain climates, or just learned over time that the manufacturer didn't include it. But in getting a idea of if one is just charging a lot more than the other, you want to take a look at that list, get pretty familiar with it, and then have them give you a list of what they do so you can compare and see, okay, are they doing more than what's on this list that's in my maintenance manual? Is one quoting me, you know, these things and one's quoting me more because they're doing more? And then what is the value of those additional things? Are they really necessary? By and large, for the most part, I believe in sticking to the manufacturer's recommendations. You know, there are exceptions, there are situations, and really they should be able to explain the value to you. You know, anytime you're having something done on a car, maintenance or repair, you know, the best way that it can be shaped by the shop presenting it to you is what this is going to do for you is this, and that this is going to be, you know, is it the durability of the car, the safety of the car, does it have to do with fuel economy, but there should be a value on what it's going to do. You know, and there's a lot of preventative things you could do to a car that manufacturers no longer include in maintenance schedules, partly because various fluids that we used to change more frequently have gone to synthetic and the systems have gotten more sophisticated, don't need as much maintenance. And you know, there are old school technicians who will tell you, nope, I still think you change that brake fluid every 2 years. And you know, if you have a brake problem and some kind of a brake system failure where the pedal goes to the floor, by golly, you're probably going to say that guy was right and I'm going to do that from now on. But that, you know, that might not be most people's experience. The other thing about the dealer and independent shop is that, you know, talk to the people that at either place. And, you know, if you can determine that the same set of services, once you pick out and they're doing just what's in that manual and they are the same price, then where do you really feel more rapport? Where does someone make you feel more comfortable? Where are they actually kind of hearing you and understanding which of those value points is important to you and kind of shaping their service around that and telling you, separating the safety items, immediate things you need to do from things that could be put off rather than just give you this flat list, got to do all this. You know, you're going to be more comfortable with somebody that you can have that rapport with. So that, you know, once you establish whether we're talking apples and apples, and if the, you know, just because the prices are different, it doesn't mean they're pricing the same things, then, you know, the next most important thing really is that you've got a good rapport with whoever you're going to work with.
There you go. Thank you, Pam, very much for calling. That's good points for a lot of people. Ray in South Mauston, it's your turn. We'll go to you.
Thank you, Larry, for taking my call. Sure. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
I'm driving a semi, so I've got a headset on, and this question has nothing to do with semis. It has to do with a trailer, a covered trailer that we take to the Dane County Farmers Market. In that trailer, I have a refrigerator and I have a freezer. And what I've done is hook up three deep cycle batteries to an inverter and then connect those to the refrigerator and the freezer.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't make it from Menominee to Madison without them going out of power. I don't know the correct term for that. Is there a way besides the generator that I could increase that power? And the second thing is, how do I test those batteries to make sure that they're actually working? Okay. And should they be taken in over the winter because they're not being used?
They should either be taken in or they should be charged. You know, for example, I store a travel trailer for somebody at my place, and ultimately I do keep that plugged in. I could just plug it in occasionally, but on that, the inverter that takes that battery power and powers other things on that trailer also helps control the charge. Deep cycle batteries have a little bit different charging needs than just a regular conventional 12-volt battery. It's kind of in stages that you charge one of those. And there's a lot of confusion when you connect a trailer hitch up. It does not charge the batteries in the trailer, either a travel trailer or the type of trailer that you're talking about. So you're probably running down the road with that refrigerator on. The fridge and freezer are probably on and,
sure,
and drawing power off of those batteries while you're underway, and that's not going to work. It is going to discharge them when you try to do it that way. So I'm presuming that you, before you leave, that you know you have those batteries fully charged.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you'd have to.
I try to. I wish there was a way that I could determine how much charge there is in the batteries.
Well,
is there a device that I can buy?
Right, you'd need to get you don't have to get a real expensive one, but a battery tester to tell you what the state of charge in them is. And of course, there are special type of chargers for deep cycle batteries, for like marine batteries. Not that you can't charge it with a conventional charger, but you're not really going to get the full charge that battery should be able to get. You're not going to get that deep cycle, that last state of charge that you should get. You could hook up a device in the vehicle that would be separate from your trailer hitch power that goes back to the trailer that would use kind of like an inverter and run power back to charge them. But yeah, a lot of people get confused by that and think that the trailer hitch should charge that deep cycle battery, but it doesn't work that way.
Yeah. Does that help out, Ray?
It did. Should I be taking those batteries out over the course of the winter? It has an electrical plug, so it's direct current when it's stationary. I plug it into the outlet, and that keeps the refrigerator and the stove running. Should I take those batteries out and bring them inside for the winter?
I would. Yeah. If you want to, it's just going to make them less likely to discharge, and if they do discharge, less likely to be damaged from being dead.
Yeah. There you go. Good luck, Ray. Thank you so much for calling. And Rod, in Weyerhaeuser, your turn now. Hi, Rod.
Hello, Larry. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead.
Your gentleman mechanic, what's his name?
It's Jim.
Jim. Hey, Jim, I'm stupid, and I do stupid things. Now, I got a Ford 150 2001. I use it like a tractor. I do things like skidding trees and stuff. Well, the other day, I backed into the fuel pump with my door open because I got a manual transmission at the C-Store in Weyerhaeuser. And, thank God there was no damage to the fuel pump. But anyhow, there was a little dent in the back where the latch is. Okay. So now what I do is I pull the handle, either the inside or the outside, and I push the latch down, and I slam the door shut. But the dinger still stays on and the dome light. Now, so all of a sudden I realize I shut the vehicle off someplace and the light is down. So I'm experimenting. So I reach down under the dash, and I just left the cover off now because I'm doing it all the time. There's three banks, three rows of fuses. There's a 5-amp fuse in the middle, and I pull it out, well, the lights will go off. So, but then I don't have wipers. And I was looking on my phone, and it's the car guru, man, and it says that the F-150 for about 6 years or something had some fuse panel problems. Now, I don't know why that backing into the pump would affect the fuse panel if it just initiated something. Do you know much about them if that's an issue?
What exactly hit the fuel pump? Was it the tailgate of the truck, or one of the rear doors was open, or what?
No, that's my door, because I had to back up and recheck how many gallons, what the price was.
Okay, I got you. So when you open a door and you look at the body of the car near the striker that the door latch closes on, there is going to be a little switch there, a little button switch that goes in and out. And what I suspect is that is either the door might have got dented right at the point where it's supposed to touch that when you close the door, and it's supposed to open that circuit. Closing the door opens the circuit, which stops the power from running the dome light and the door jar light. So, I mean, this probably is a much simpler solution. Just take a look at that. If the door's dented, you could try to take the dent out, but honestly, I've seen people take a piece of duct tape and a little chip of wood and tape it there just so it would contact that switch. I mean, you can get more sophisticated. Obviously, the proper way would be if there's a dent and it's not contacting the switch, or if the switch is damaged, to address that and do that repair. But just from what you're describing, I don't think this is a fuse box problem. I mean, you could try pulling fuses to interrupt the power, but it would be a lot easier to get to the root of the problem, which is going to have something to do with what that courtesy switch for that door that controls the dome light. Something got bent or dented so that's not engaging properly anymore, and that's where you want to look.
Yeah, there you go. Good luck, Rod. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Interesting. Scott in Winona, Minnesota, your turn. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Larry. I have a question. When my father was still alive, he always recommended when the temperature got below freezing to turn your headlights on briefly for a couple seconds and before you started the car. You know, shut them off and then start the car. Was that just bogus folklore, or is there any efficacy to that?
There, it really can't help the battery start the car. It's true that when you draw power off of a battery, you create electrical excitation. The cells in that battery move more. The same thing's going to happen when you turn the key to operate the starter and it goes to draw power. Now, the theory always was that, well, the lights are a much lesser power draw, and they are a much lesser power draw. And so that excitation may help the battery when you go to start the engine. I just can't get behind that. There's so much power there. There's just so much, period. There's only so many cold cranking amps available, and that's a term that is important to talk about, is that cold cranking amps are how a battery's rated. It's how much power it has at 0 degrees. A battery should be able to maintain at least 7.2 volts for 30 seconds at 0 degrees. So batteries usually have cold cranking amp ratings much higher than they need to be, because they're really rated to start that car when it's cold. When it's warm, they have a lot more. So there's only so much available. So you're turning those lights on. If that battery barely had enough and is marginal, you might just cut the difference between actually being able to start it and not. And the excitation of the cells in the battery is going to happen when you turn the starter key anyway. So I've heard that. I've heard that all my career. It just doesn't add up to me, you know.
All right. There you go, Scott. Dad wasn't necessarily right in that case. Let's take a call from Rich in Two Rivers. Hi, Rich.
Yeah, good morning. How are you two doing?
Great. Appreciate the call.
Yeah, I got the greatest wisdom to bestow on the general population since the invention of the battery. It's the Battery Buddy. I bought a conversion van back in 1995. I'm still driving it. And it had because of the conversion, it had a Battery Buddy on it. And a Battery Buddy, you can get on eBay or whatever for $38. I've seen it for. And the wires go to the Battery Buddy, then go to your battery, and it has a circuit breaker. So if your battery gets down below the level that it can't start the vehicle, it won't. You go into your vehicle, everything's dead. You go out, you hit the switch, starts it up, no matter if it's 10 below, 20 below. And it's not only good for that situation, which is great, it's also good for diagnostics, because what happened one time, my wife was taking my child up to the airport in Minneapolis to fly out, and she called me up and she says, the van just stopped on the middle of the road. And she pulled over, and I said, she has no electricity. Well, the alternator went out, and I said, hit the button and don't run any electrical. And she made it all the way to the airport and all the way back, and it's never failed me once.
No.
Yep. Good device. I mean, it's similar, again, to deep cycle batteries and travel trailers will not allow the way the circuitry is set up, the inverter, and that's a far more expensive device than a battery buddy. That's a pretty inexpensive thing, but they don't allow the power to run down below a third of the lower third of charge. But yeah, it just senses the state of the battery charge, and if it gets down to a certain point, it opens the circuit so it doesn't discharge anymore. It's manufacturers by and large haven't really adopted that, but it's not an expensive device. It's not difficult to install, and it can save you in a pinch. Yep, it is one of those things kind of seldom heard of and seldom known, but it can definitely bail you out in situations like you're describing.
Absolutely. Thank you, Rich. Appreciate the call. Talking with Jim Ward, Service Director at Smart Motors of Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your vehicle today and any maintenance issues you might have, Larry Mueller here with my guest Jim Ward, Service Director at Smart Motors of Madison. He comes by every couple months to talk with us. Always great to have him come by. And lots of callers online, so we will turn to Carol in Appleton. Carol, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. I'd like to have Jim talk about AGM batteries. Many of them are the spiral wound type, like my husband put into our hybrid vehicle because of, the small battery is kind of vulnerable to being run down if you're not careful. And also we have another car that sits a lot, and so we used an AGM in that. And perhaps he could talk about the advantages of an AGM battery.
Okay, thank you for calling, Carol.
Sure,
Jim?
Sure. Well, the use and utilization of AGM batteries, it's a gas mat battery, came about because they don't outgas like a conventional battery. A conventional battery is going to be outside the cabin, not where you are in the car. And there are certain advantages to having the car, that having a battery inside the cabin. The Prius hybrid uses an AGM battery, and it's in the trunk usually, sometimes under the rear seat, depending on the model. But those, it's a better environment for a battery, we don't see corrosion problems like we do with batteries that are on the outside. And again, it doesn't outgas, so there's not gases that you have to breathe. It's a battery that, by and large, when we talked about that 1% chance that something can go wrong, that battery doesn't have those gases over and over. It doesn't have that kind of an issue. So, I mean, for their uses, I'm not going to say necessarily it's a better battery, because usually these are smaller batteries that are not really running the starter when you go to start a car. Typically they're running computers, and that starting power actually comes usually from a larger battery in a hybrid. But yep, it's just a different application of battery. And again, the primary use of it is because you can put it in the cabin of the car with the passengers.
Yeah, makes sense. All right, Carol, thank you very much for calling. Jim in Eau Claire, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hello. Say, I got a question about tire pressure. What it says on the car recommended is usually 32, but some of the tires are 10 to 12 pounds. They want 40 or 46 pounds at the most.
Mm-hmm.
What's the best way to do that?
You want to use the placard that's on the vehicle, on the driver's door jamb. The tire manufacturer doesn't know what that tire is going on. What he does know is that no matter what you're putting it on, here's a maximum pressure that this tire is not designed to withstand more than. So it may be 40, 45 pounds, but that may be way too much for the application. In fact, it almost always is far greater than the vehicle application that you're going to use that tire for. So manufacturers will have a placard on the door jamb that'll tell you what size your tire should be and what the tire pressure should be. The other thing is that in cold climates, most manufacturers will have a chart that will show you a slight increase in pressure, anywhere from 2, 3, 4 pounds, that you would put in that tire in the cold weather, because there is somewhat of a pressure loss in cold, and you're better off to be, you may very well under those circumstances drive around with a couple pounds too much once the tires warm up, but that's actually better than driving with 4 or 5, 6, 7 pounds too little in the tire. So there are charts too to look and see what you could increase it to. It's not a critical thing that you use that chart and do that. If you set it at the pressure that's on that door jamb, you're going to be fine.
All right, there we go. Thanks, Jim. Dave in Madison, your turn. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Larry. Hey, I just have a quick question. When you're talking about storing batteries before, I had heard, and someone had told me a long time ago, that you never store a battery sitting on a concrete floor and that you have to put them someplace else. And I'm just curious if that's true, and how should the battery be stored? And I'll just listen online.
Yeah, I always stuck mine on a piece of wood.
Yep, and that is what is recommended. If you're going to put it in a garage or something like that you put it on wood. A battery can have a coating around it that allows it to have a surface charge, and that can allow it to also surface to discharge that way. And the cement floor can be a medium where, because of moisture levels that can vary in a cement floor, that can actually allow that discharge. So that is true. That can happen, and it's preferable to store the battery on wood.
All right. On to Mike in Racine. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Hey, I just wanted to get back at the trick of trying to trick your battery with turn the headlights on or whatever. That actually does have a foundation in the science of chemical batteries. Is basically the short story is that the chemical battery, the rate of reaction in the battery is driven by temperature. So the colder it gets, the slower that reaction runs, and therefore, you can have a significant power loss if it's extremely cold. Now, having said that, if you discharge a battery, that chemical reaction is reversed, and it's highly exothermic. In other words, it gives off heat. What the trick is that you have to discharge your battery, and you have to discharge it at a high enough rate that it actually increases the temperature of the battery more than it decreases the amount of charge used to do that. Now, the thing is, from a safety perspective, there really is only one way to do that, and I would never sit here and recommend it, but you basically short-circuit the battery for a very short moment in time. It increases the temperature of the battery enough that if the battery had a good charge but it was just cold, like it was minus 30 or something like that,
yep,
and start the car. And I have done it, and I have seen it done. It does work, but it's extremely dangerous. You got to have safety gear on. You got to have all kinds of stuff, because if you discharge the battery too fast and too hard, you will blow the battery up from having it short-circuited. So take it for what it is.
Yep. I mean, and no question. I mean, that can be true. That's not quite the same is turning headlights on and giving it that brief tickle. That's not really going to do much to raise the temperature of that battery. But, you know, I have been in situations where I was out somewhere without any way to do anything except take the battery out of the car and take it inside a cabin where we were staying, warm it up. That absolutely will work. That is something where, you know, whether you do it quickly, and obviously it's far safer to do it slowly if you have that means. You know, there are lots of things you can do with battery and electrical technology that some of it should really stay to engineers and people that, you know, again, you sound like you know what you're doing. You know, I think most people are better off to rub the rabbit's foot and hope and not try that at all.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you, Mike. Appreciate it. And Gary in Lime Springs, Iowa.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for the show.
You bet.
My question is about a 1999 Mercury Mountaineer, and just start all of a sudden, step on the... Well, if you have the turn signals on either direction, step on the brake, it'll shut them off. It'll just freeze them up. And on the back, when you step on the brake, all the lights come on, the brake lights, and they're separate, the turn signals and the brake lights, but they all come on then. Any ideas?
Well, I've seen some of that kind of behavior between lights. A lot of vehicles will use what are called dual filament bulbs, where one bulb will serve two different purposes. And if you have a dual filament bulb where one of the filaments has failed and it's actually disconnected on one side but is just leaning over and touching the other filament, it can create that kind of a scenario. You know, also anything in the taillight housings themselves or in that wiring that is touching circuits together that way will create the same thing. But I actually, over the years, more often than not, I've seen just a dual filament bulb where one filament failed and was touching the other side.
Oh, so if you change out the bulb and
right, and it's not necessarily that obvious, because you know one of the bulb functions still works, so you don't presume that the bulb is a problem, but it can be.
All right, there you go, Gary. Thank you. And Hugh in Muscadet, your turn.
Hello, I have a 2013 Honda CR-V, and I'm having a problem getting the heat on the driver's side. I called the dealership, and they said it was some sort of a maintenance item, but they wouldn't tell me what.
Well, there are different things that can cause that. I mean, ultimately, the heater box is just a housing that all of your ducts connect to, that the fresh air coming in connects to. And that heater box, as cars have gotten more sophisticated and have dual climate control, those boxes have gotten more sophisticated. I mean, so there's quite a few different things that can happen here, from having an actuator that's supposed to operate a door, get out of sync, or being broken, or having a rod that connects it disconnect. It usually is not what I would call a maintenance item. I would call it more repair, but you know that it can come anywhere from just having to locate and reconnect something to sometimes they're not repairable and you have to replace the whole box, and it can be really expensive because the dash is all kind of built around it. But you know, it sounds like they're familiar with it, and hopefully in your case it is just a matter of reconnecting a rod, which maintenance is usually lower expensive. If that's going to make the expense lower, I'm all for calling it maintenance, but typically that's not a recommended maintenance item.
Jim Ward, our guest today, he'll be with us right up till 12:30 today. We'll take a quick look at the news and weather, find out what else is in store for us, and then we'll be back. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here taking a look at vehicle maintenance issues today with Jim Ward, service director, at Smart Motors of Madison. Great to have him back, and certainly thank you for listening in. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or phone at 800-642-1234 if you have a vehicle question. Annie in La Crosse has one, so let's go to her. Hi, Annie.
Hi. Say, I have a 2004 Chevy Astro. It has about 110,000 miles. The last couple of months, something strange has happened with the lights. The inside light, like the dome light, doesn't go on when I open the door. And the radio, when I turn the car off, used to stay on until I open the door. It doesn't do that anymore. The headlights used to go on all the time when I started the car. Now I have to turn them on during the daylight. And so I'm just wondering, could this just be a fuse, or am I looking at something disastrous?
No, it could just be a fuse. You said that was an 04. I don't think an 04 had settings. I mean, there's customizable settings that can be set up to make certain things like lights and radios function before or after the ignition's on, that the memory of those can be lost if the battery discharges and they might have to be reprogrammed. I don't think an 04 Astro Van probably had that, but a blown fuse certainly could give you the same thing. There's a circuit that isn't telling it to do the same thing. You could have a wiring problem or something too, but certainly the first thing to do is to check the fuses. Take a look at the owner's manual. If it mentions anything about custom parameters or custom settings, then maybe that does have some settings that if you had a battery discharge, certainly on the last handful of years of cars, that's a very common thing that you can set it up to work this way or that way, whichever way you want, and those settings can be lost with a dead battery and then have to be reset again after that. So
there you go. Thank you, Annie. Appreciate the call. Ken in Mayville, hello.
Hey, howdy, Jim. Being from Wyoming, I don't normally have moisture issues, and I'm got some questions. I'm trying to figure out, is there a way of cleaning out the condenser, the evaporator drip pan in a vehicle? I have, in the summertime, like clockwork, I get little fungus gnats hatching. And I know it's got to be something that's going on in the with the moisture coming off the evaporator and dripping down. I do get some fluid draining out. I do notice that it is draining, but not fully. So I was wondering if there's a way of cleaning that out at all.
There is. I mean, you want to be a little careful with this process. They actually make foam spray-in cleaners that are like a two-step process that you can put some in from the top. you kind of spray it in when you have the fan on high, and it pulls it in from where the fresh air intake is up underneath your wipers. And you know, you probably need a little guidance to show you just where these things go. But and then there's another product that there's a hose outlet evaporator that's supposed to drain the water that forms on that evaporator, and you know that little pan is supposed to drip out the bottom of the car. That hose can get restricted as leave and tree debris come into the intake. Eventually they can settle down into that pan and partially plug that hose. They also, there are parts of the country where they have insect intrusion issues that will climb up into those hoses seeking moisture, and so they actually have a little plug that the water can come out through, but the plug tip is permethrin, so that keeps the insects from going up in there. But we don't see much of that in this part of the country. I don't know that they do in Wyoming either, where we get enough cold weather that we don't have that issue. But it's probably tree debris. You know, you want to be a little careful about running anything up that hose. I mean, you know, one might be inclined to take a coat hanger and try going up there, but you could damage the evaporator. You don't want to, you know, poke a hole through that thing or do any damage. So the least invasive way is to take those spray-in foam cleaners. You know, you usually start with the top one, spray about half of that in, then you spray the one that's meant for the bottom up through that evaporator drain hose, then you do the top again, and it's supposed to flush and drain that all, and it does work. We see an emerging issue over the years here, over the last decade or so. There's more particulates in the air than there used to be. Those particulates will allow molds and mildews to form inside those surfaces that tend to stay a little bit damp, and I mean, that is an emerging problem. You know, people have allergies to those kind of things, so it can be more than just a musty smell, but it's not uncommon at all that people report, you know, more than we ever used to see, kind of a musty gym socks kind of smell from the ventilation system of the car, and that's what it's from. So yeah, there are products that are specifically made to clean that out.
Is there a specific name for the product again, or is it?
Well, it's often called an AC refresh, which is not AC the same refresh. as, you know, you're not going into the refrigerant system. It's not right. It's not that. It's just the ducts in the ductwork system that it's actually cleaning out.
There we go. Thanks, Ken. Appreciate it. And Irvin and Burnett, your turn.
Yes, my 204 Buick Century, which I bought new, the Delco battery in it finally died this year. But the original Delco battery had a quarter-inch foam jacket slipped on it. I was wondering if there was any value to that or if it was just for cosmetic purposes.
Well, there is. We were talking earlier about temperatures of batteries having everything to do with the power that the battery's got available, and that's true. So the thought with those is that as you're driving the car and the engine compartment gets completely warmed up and that battery gets as warm as it's going to get while you're driving it, given whatever the outside temperatures are, and you know this is more of a wintertime thing, that once you shut that car off, that insulated foam jacket will keep the heat in that battery longer and potentially, you know, give you greater power later when you go to start it. You know, marginally true. You know, if the car sits long enough, obviously it's going to lose all that heat and there's no advantage, but there's some marginal truth to that. I don't see that on cars as often as I used to. I know exactly what you're talking about, and I used to see it on a lot of cars back in the 70s and 80s, and you know, I think that the marginal part of it was such that I don't think it gave enough benefit that manufacturers found it worth to keep putting those on. But yep, again, like a lot of the things we talk about, you know, that sometimes the difference between a car starting and not in a cold winter day when that battery might be a little old and marginal, that might be just enough. So I wouldn't say that there's nothing to it, but again, it's one of those marginal things that's not going to make a great deal of difference.
Mary emailed to ask how the check tire inflation indicator works. She had it come on every couple of weeks this fall. She found a one tire that was lower, 28 PSI in pressure, and would refill it only to have this repeat several weeks later. She took the car in to have that tire checked for a slow leak, and the tire guys couldn't find anything. Temperature wasn't fluctuating too wildly during this period. What do you think might be going on there?
Well, a couple of questions there. In terms of how the tire indicator works, there are two types of systems. The early primitive ones really simply counted the revolutions of each wheel and had a little computer that would take into account that when you go around a corner, the outside wheels have to turn more than the other, so it would take that calculation into account, and over a period of time, 15, 20 minutes, it could determine, okay, one of these tires, which are all theoretically the same size, is spinning more than the others, even with the turns taken into consideration. Therefore, it has to be a smaller diameter, and that happens because it's low on air. The newer systems actually have a little sensor inside the tire that is part of the air valve that you put the air in that when the tire is inflated properly, is going to vibrate at a certain frequency. And that little device is going to give a radio signal. It's going to be picked up by a receiver inside the car, and a little more sophisticated, it's able to tell the tire pressures using that. It is also, that later technology then allowed us to also monitor the spare tire, because the tire doesn't have to be on the ground and spinning for these to vibrate. Just the car going down the road and the vibration it creates will be different in the spare tire as well as the tires that are on the ground, and be able to tell if one is low. So that's how the tire indicators work. But in terms of your tire, a tire that has a slow leak, you know, I wouldn't say that we have never looked at a tire in any shop I've ever worked in and missed a puncture. They don't always leak. I mean, checking tire leaks is one of the things where technology hasn't come a long way in finding that leak. It's about as primitive as it ever was with pneumatic air-filled tires. So you know, you can put it underwater and watch for bubbles. You can put soapy water on it and watch for bubbles, but it may not leak at all times. If the tire had a puncture, I think you'd have realized it by now. So my suspicion in this particular case is that there was what's called a bead leak. The tire, the edge of the tire where it mounts to the wheel, goes into a little groove. That groove is prone to have a little corrosion in it, which can make it almost seem porous, and you can get some slow leakage at times. And it may, you know, it may start from hitting a pothole, and you hit a pothole again a month later, and it may stop. I mean, I've definitely seen it where it's intermittent, and it doesn't do it all the time, you know. But if it's an intermittent thing that just doesn't happen all the time but does periodically, then it may make sense to have that tire dismounted, have that tire bead groove cleaned up, you know, the wire brush it, and then put a coating on it that helps prevent it from allowing that kind of porosity leak. That's probably what was going on there. It's also possible that the tire fill valve has got a little valve in it called a Schrader valve, and those can get loose and those can leak as well, but those are the most likely areas.
There we go. Let's take another call, this one from Steve in Madison. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are you gentlemen doing today?
Great, appreciate the call.
So I've got a 1998 Mercury Mountaineer. I guess it's a bad day to be a Mountaineer owner.
Yeah.
But started it up, turned on the fan and the defroster to defrost the windows, and got a roaring whine electrical kind of thing in the center console where the CD changer is. And that was followed by, I had it on a couple of seconds, then I had like a molten plastic smell, so I shut it off. And I'm just wondering, any troubleshooting or ideas you might have? It was not the defroster, it was the fan that prompted it, but they both were on.
Well, you know, there could be lots of things going on here, but that particular set of symptoms, particularly the hot odor, on most blower fans in most cars, the blower fan itself basically runs at one speed, but it's got a resistor pack, which is what gives you the different speeds. When you turn your blower switch from low to high, it's picking different levels of resistance, and that blower fan then operates at different speeds. Far more common than the blower motor burning out is that resistor pack burning out. When that happens, usually the fan will still work on high, but you don't have any of your lower speeds. And when it burns out, it does produce an odor. So I can't be sure. That's a fairly vague set of symptoms. It could be something else, but in my experience over the years, that has most often been what happened when people describe what you're describing.
Oh, there you go. Steve, does that help?
That's a different fan. That's not the big fan in the front by the radiator.
No, we're talking about the fan in the dash that blows your heat or air conditioning onto you. Yep.
Great.
Yep.
Hey, thanks so much. Happy holidays.
Yep, to you as well, Steve. And let's go to Ron in La Crosse. Hi, Ron.
Hey there. How you guys doing?
Good.
It's just wonderful to listen to somebody who knows what he's doing, you know?
I agree, Ron.
Well, I have one thing that's driving me crazy, is, and I, where the last person you talked to about the tires, I have a Denali, and it's got the big tires on it, and the four indicators on the dash for the tires sometimes will give it, they're all different. So I bought a special tire gauge, and I physically checked them, and they don't match what's on the dash. So I put, say, 34 pounds in all four, use my
manual gauge, check, make sure that's exactly right. And then I turn the key on in the dash, and it'll say 27, 28, 32. I don't understand it.
Yeah.
I was thinking it was aluminum rims, maybe, or change in temperature. I'm less lost.
Well, if it were at the tire of the wheel, I wouldn't expect all of them to have the same issue. So it's you can have one sensor and one tire quit working or malfunction and get an incorrect reading or no reading at all from it. But when it's all of them, it makes you suspect that the receiver that is getting the signals from them is what's got the issue. There's something likely wrong with that receiver. I'm not familiar enough with that Denali's set of service bulletins. Sometimes those kind of things can be a known factory issue, and often the repair is simply a software reflash to put in a software that'll correct some glitch that it's got. And this sounds like one of those kind of things. Those systems also use... Often the receiver that's getting those tire pressure signals is the same one that your keyless system uses to open the doors. So when you use a keyless remote, that can affect it. So sometimes we see when equipment's been added onto a car, like an aftermarket alarm or remote start or something that wasn't necessarily, might not be compatible with the original factory equipment, we can get some strange functions of other systems, you know, or you wouldn't necessarily think the tire pressure system would have anything to do with the remote start or with a keyless entry system, but it can because they use the same computer to operate in a lot of vehicles. So, from what you're describing, I don't think this is at the individual wheels. I think this is at the receiver circuitry that's receiving those signals.
Tire pressure gauges, many a year ago, I was in a wedding, Al and Julie Johnson, and as a gift for being in the wedding, all of the guys got tire pressure gauges, which I have followed from, I still have it in my car from car to car to car. And it's just one of those kind you push and then the weight comes out the back end of the gauge. How accurate are those?
They get off. They do get off. About once a year in a shop. Well, and the thing is, people who do that for a living, like technicians now, have more and more sophisticated devices that are digital.
Yeah.
But the old mechanical type, like you're describing, would get off. And I remember, now it's fall. We're starting to get the tire pressure parades in the mornings. And we'd realize, or you'd have somebody that had incorrect tire pressures after it had been serviced. And, this is the time of year. Let's have everybody check the same, the same set of tires on a car with their gauges and figure out whose gauge is sticky. That can certainly happen. So it's if something seems fishy about the reading you're getting, you may want to get a new gauge or compare it to somebody else's because those mechanical ones they can get sticky and hung up and not give you the right pressure.
And I think mine's still working pretty well.
I remember I bought one, a Snap-on one time that was brass and beautiful but you can buy them for 50 cents. And so there's something to, you get what you pay for to some degree. The cheaper ones, I've had them fall completely apart, really, and expensive ones before, too, where you put it on the tire and the little gauge thing flies right out the back. So
yeah. Well, this one even has my name on engraved on it. So it's a nice one.
Can't beat that.
Even if it didn't work, I'd hang on to it.
Yep.
Let's go to Carl in Waterford. Hi, Carl.
Hello.
Yeah, what's on your mind?
I've got a 1986 Ford F-150. The wiper switch is just two speed, and the washer is all in the one switch. I wanted to put intermediate on there, and I found the switch for intermediate. My question is, do I have to do something with the wiper motor also?
I think we're talking about intermittent, not to be a stickler on language, but intermediate would be a different speed than fast or slow. Intermittent is where your wipers aren't continuously wiping. They wipe and then there's
right.
a delay, right? So intermittent wipers function typically as in the switch. And in most vehicles, replacing the switch gives you that function. I don't know of any application where the intermittent function is in the wiper. The wiper motor is simply doing what the switch tells it to. So, yep, buying that switch, it's usually the same connector as the other switch that doesn't have intermittent, and yep, you're typically good to go. That should work.
All right, there you go, Carl. Thank you. And Randy in Waterloo, hello.
Hello. I've got a 2012 Toyota Tacoma pickup truck, and just within the last half hour, the check engine light came on and the track off light came on at the same time.
Any idea what's going on?
Well, those are two different systems, but it's not unusual for the lights to come on together. Typically, there's two different computers, one for the traction control, one for the engine management. And often, when one of them has a code stored in it, the other one will say, okay, I'm out too. Yeah, intentionally, it's a default that the manufacturers make. Often, your cruise control won't work when one of those or both of those lights are on, just as a default, as a safety. So, you know, a lot of times people think they got multiple problems. The vehicle needs to have the computer scan and get the code out of it. You know, most often with a check engine light, the most common thing is a evaporative emission code related to a loose gas cap. We don't see that as much in the winter because gas doesn't produce those evaporative pressures and emissions much in colder weather, but it hasn't been that cold. Usually about 40 degrees is that cutoff, and we've been flirting right around that range. Mm-hmm. So if you just got gas in the last couple of days, I would probably try tightening up that gas cap. That won't make the light go off immediately, but if that was it, the light will go off within a day or two because those systems use what they call two-trip logic. It doesn't turn. Lots of fluky things happen when we drive a car around in weather, and so often when it sees those codes, it doesn't turn the light on the first time it sees it. It makes a note of it. It sees it again on a couple more drive cycles and says, okay, there is a problem. Same way when you correct it. If tightening that gas cap corrects it, the next time you start it, it's going to say, oh, looks like it might be fixed. I'm going to leave the light on until I see another couple of drive cycles that it says this is okay. If that doesn't resolve it, as long as the light's not flashing, the vehicle's safe to drive. But do keep in mind, if the track off is light, the track is on, the traction control is not going to work in a situation where you're on dicey road. So that's probably the most important thing to be aware of. And if tightening the gas cap doesn't do it, then you want to get it scanned and find out what the code is, and that's going to lead you to where the testing needs to start from there.
All right. Thank you for calling, Randy. And Walton Fort Atkinson, your turn.
Good afternoon, Larry and guest. I just want to follow up on Gary, who called in earlier about a Mountaineer with some strange taillight behavior. And my experience as a retired mechanic and a Ford dealership mechanic is this used to be more common that it's frequently a bad ground. So it could be a bad ground wire at that assembly in the taillight or a bad body ground. And it also could be your suggestion was, too, that a filament is dropped and is rerouting the current. But have him check for a ground. And I'll give you a little tip. Go to the dealer, ask for an EVTM, electrical vacuum troubleshooting manual. And for that year, they'll let you use it, probably even let you take it home. That will show you the location of all the grounds. It's a great book. So good luck with that, Gary, if you're listening.
Yeah,
all
good
right.
Tip, Walt. Good tip.
Walt, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And, boy, here we are out of time. I'm really glad you were able to come by again, Jim. It's always a great pleasure. I learn a lot every single time, and I think everybody else who listens in does as well. So thanks again.
I do, too. It's good to be here.
Well, and you're back on February 21st. We'll do it all over again.
Right.
All right. Jim Ward, our guest today, he is the service director at Smart Motors. He's over 10 years of master certification, worked on vehicles since about 1978. He knows an awful lot. Tomorrow on Garden Talk, Mark Conlock from the Green Bay Botanical Gardens is back with us once again to talk about why starting plants from seeds is such a good idea and how to do it. That's tomorrow at 11. And Saturday morning, we'll replay that first hour at 6 o'clock, or you can listen to the whole thing online at any time. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store.